Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. Now, this year marks 300 years since Britain got its first Prime Minister in the shape of Robert Walpole. On My Times radio show, we've done a different Prime Minister every week with Andrew Jimson, who's got this brilliant book, Jimson's Prime Ministers, Brief Lives from Walpole to Johnson. So what we thought we'd do, doing them all would take you weeks to listen through to them all, but what we thought we'd do is take a look back on the Prime Ministers from Thatcher to Johnson. So we kick off then with the Iron Lady. It's Andrew Jimson discussing Margaret Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher, where to begin? Such an extraordinarily influential Prime Minister, but still, even now, incredibly controversial and divisive, what, more than 40 years after she entered number 10?
I think she inspired greater extremes of adoration and loathing than any other Prime Minister in modern times. And she imposed her personality more deeply on the country than any leader since Churchill. Nigel Lawson said the key to understanding Mrs. Thatcher was that she actually said what she believed. And this is a very unusual thing. Women perhaps do it more than the men who surrounded her, often couldn't understand her. They like Boris Johnson, they use the standard English methods of evasion, jokes, paradoxes, understatement, any number of ironical devices which enable one to avoid actually committing oneself to anything. And she rendered those devices unusable. She actually said what she thought and was not a defeatist. Most of the political class at that time were defeatists, and her own wet colleagues, socially much grander than her, they really thought that within a year or two she'd have to abandon these policies of hers, and just like Edward Heath 10 years before, she'd have to have a U-turn, and she proved them wrong. It was very, very precarious. Although she lasted in office for 11 years and 209 days, which is a longer period of continuous service than anyone since Lord Liverpool, her situation was always precarious, which actually is quite right. In a free country, the situation of the Prime Minister should be precarious.
Let's go back to 1979 or 1974, or 75, when she actually became a Conservative Party leader. Even today, we still tick off the first woman in various roles. We've still never had a woman chancellor, you know, even in the sort of general life, leading major businesses or, I don't know, presenting Football Focus or whatever it might be. Even in 2021, we're still ticking off the first time a woman has done a particular job. How extraordinary was it that she emerged to replace Ted Heath back in 75?
It was very extraordinary because she wasn't seen as a prime minister in waiting. She'd served as education secretary from 1970 to 1974 and had been pretty loyal. I mean, she didn't have any particular affinity with Heath. But she'd been pretty loyal to him. And Heath, of course, lost both the elections in 74, and the Tory MPs were very, very angry, and he was very, very rude to them. And various senior figures thought, well, we're going to have a leadership contest and we'll come in the second round. We must be loyal to Heath in the first round. She became the person with the courage to take him on in the first round. She had Airy Neave running her campaign, the Colditz SKP. He did a very, very skillful job and understated her support. But the troops were mutinous and they mutinied, and she did so well on the first round that that was it. She was the new leader. A tremendous shock for the Tory party, but an example of its ability to reinvent itself. And yes, the first woman, people throughout her time in office, many people really had no idea how to talk to her. And many people were deeply affronted by her, particularly intellectuals. They thought it was their duty to, Ian McEwan said after she died in 2013, he said it was never enough to dislike her. We liked disliking her. And Jonathan Miller, for example, said she had the diction of a perfumed fart. I mean, it really was. The present prime minister comes in for a lot of criticism, but I think because there was a big element of misogyny, I think what Thatcher got was even worse. On the other hand, she also got more adoration than the present prime minister gets. So it was a very extreme sort of spectrum of opinion that she aroused.
And in part because, like you said, she had a clear sense of what she wanted to do, and she got on and did it. And people can argue, well, you know, her treatment about the treatment of the miners, defeating the NUM, you know, or there's the Falklands or whatever it might be, or the economy, you know, sticking to her guns on the economy despite unemployment rising to 3 million, but dramatically yes. changing the economy of the UK in a way that, you know, nobody's sought to, well, certainly nobody in number 10 has sought to reverse since. No. On her terms, she was successful. Even if you might disagree with what she did have a clear sense of what she wanted to do.
She did, and although she was also highly pragmatic, she didn't have the showdown with the miners until there were, you know, good coal stocks and every prospect of winning it. And the trade union reforms were quite cautious, step-by-step, sensible reforms. The end product, partly because of the dreadful unemployment and the collapse of a lot of British industry, was that the power of the unions was smashed to this day. So that was, we had flexible labour markets and people, you know, managers could manage and so on. And a great many state enterprises were privatised. As soon as she came in, she got rid of things like exchange controls, where you couldn't take more than a certain amount of money abroad, and bizarre things like that, which now seem totally bizarre. So she liberalised the economy. She and her friends, I mean, following what the Institute of Economic Affairs had been preaching for decades in the wilderness, at the Centre for Policy Studies, they worked out how to take this new economic approach, partly pioneered by James Callaghan, her predecessor, in 1976 when he had spending cuts. But anyhow, she did it very thoroughly and for 11 years. But of course, in the end, she overplayed her hand, the poll tax and on Europe as well. She tended to fall out with people like Geoffrey Howe and Nigel Lawson, who had been great allies of hers in the early years. So the whole thing, she lost her own party, actually. They, of course, were those third-rate Tory MPs, just realistic to know enough that they're totally unemployable in any other capacity apart from Tory MPs. So it tremendously anxious to win the next election. And she'd won three elections, 79, 83 and 87, staggering achievement. But they thought she was taking them onto the rocks by 1990. So Heseltine stood against her, and they looked around. She looked around once she realised she couldn't carry on herself for a stop Heseltine candidate. And who should it be but the man from Brixton, John Major, just there at the right time and able to give the Thatcherites sufficient impression that he was one of them. So in he came. It was a really tremendous, the downfall of Thatcher was one of the great sort of political events. The Tories are very good at having these leadership rows, actually. They had another one in 2016. They had one in 1963, one in 1940, one in 1922. They do it every so often. They have a tremendous sort of internal battle about who should now lead the party. No doubt they'll have another of those in due course. But the getting rid of Thatcher, it was like killing. It was a sort of act of, many of them felt it was like sort of killing their mother. And the party, of course, took a very, very long time to recover from.
And it's still slightly in the grip of it now. That's the thing. You've got, whether it's Liz Truss posing as Margaret Thatcher on a tank.
Yes.
You know, a cultural reference point, which is what, 40 years old now, but is still, it still seems to resonate with a certain type of toy.
It still resonates. Quite a few people in Boris Johnson's cabinet were inspired when young by Margaret Thatcher. Kwasi Kwarteng did a book about her, and Kwasi Kwarteng's mother is a devout Methodist, and Margaret Thatcher, of course, was from a Methodist household with a very strong sort of distinction between right and wrong, which she carried into politics. And that very strongly appealed to some, not only to many people in this country, but to many people who came to this country. In the case of Kwasi Kwarteng's parents, they came from Ghana, and his mother, Thatcher was this idea of self-sufficiency, of the vigorous virtues, had a strong appeal to some immigrants as well as to many people in this who were already living here.
Yeah. So that was Margaret Thatcher there, who then, of course, handed over, if that's the right word, to John Major, Andrew Jimson. John Major, in many ways, couldn't have been more different to Margaret Thatcher. But the sort of the caricature of him now, the grey man who tucks his shirt into his underpants, you don't get to be Prime Minister by being that caricature, do you?
No, and you certainly don't get to win the next general election, which everyone thinks you're going to lose. He won in 1992 against Neil Kinnock, and that was a very impressive thing. His one trump card was not being Margaret Thatcher, and he got rid of the hated poll tax, and he was adopting a more emollient tone on Europe. But it did, after that, it very soon went wrong, because we had Black Wednesday, the pound crashed out of the exchange rate mechanism, and John Major, along with Douglas Hurd, they twisted Margaret Thatcher's arm and forced her to take us into the exchange rate mechanism at what turned out to be an overvalued rate. And then Helmut Kohl wouldn't stretch out his hand and save the British pound. I mean, why should he? He was there to, the Deutschmark was the German currency. So that was a catastrophe. And the Chancellor, Norman Lamont, stayed in post for 8 months after that. And really, although, in fact, oddly enough, devaluation was just what the British economy needed, and the economy started to grow quite well, and Ken Clark became Chancellor, and people started to get more prosperous. None of the credit for this went to the Conservatives. In fact, made it easier to trust the Labour Party. So Major was in a very, very tough position, and his own troops rebelled. I mean, he was heard describing them as the bastards. It's quite a small group of them, but a small but very determined group of Eurosceptics could make his life a misery in the House of Commons. So that was very, very difficult. And then in an attempt to relaunch his government, he said, let's have back to basics. And he didn't really mean that this was that everyone should be sort of lead lives of complete sort of monastic virtue or uxorious virtue. But of course, the press interpreted as being about people's sex lives. There was various grotesque sex scandals. There were also some financial scandals. So Tory sleaze became a very, very difficult thing to deal with, because it wasn't just looking for parties at number 10. Once you've got sort of hundreds of Tory MPs, you're bound to find some of them who've been doing something which looks pretty embarrassing in the papers. And so there was a lot of that. And he couldn't ever really get back on the front foot. Lost heavily in 1997, resigned immediately and went off to watch cricket at the Oval. He had got the Irish peace process going. He'd done all sorts of things, but those years when he was, as Norman Lamont unkindly put it, in office but not in power, those perhaps are one of the things about him which linger a bit in people's memory.
But it's interesting, and the point you make in your book is the economy was growing by the time he left office. That, like I said, the Northern Ireland peace process was in train. You know, the National Lottery was a John Major.
Yes. So,
but he actually doesn't really get. He just gets remembered as the grey man and Tory sleaze, and he leading the Tories to the worst result ever. But actually, because the winner takes the spoils, I suppose.
It's very, very difficult following a tremendously dominant figure like Margaret Thatcher. I mean, obviously for Brown, it was difficult following Blair. For Douglas Hume, it was difficult following Macmillan. So to be the sort of tail end Charlie is a tricky thing. But there he was. He was there for 7 years. It's not a bad record.
So, Andrew, from John Major, we now turn to Prime Minister number 51, Tony Blair.
Yes, the most successful Labour leader ever. Though he said before he became Prime Minister that his work would be complete once he had taught the Labour Party to love Peter Mandelson. And that I don't think he ever did quite manage. But he did win three elections in a row. And at the beginning, he was staggeringly effective opponent to John Major. And Blair knew how to talk to everyone from a duchess to a cleaning lady. He could adopt the right tone. And he had a genius, I'm afraid, for annoying his own party and thereby convincing Middle England that he must be a sound enough chap and was really a bit of a Tory. And so it was a tremendous electoral, it was a tremendous electoral record. No question about that. In fact, that's one of the many things which many people in the Labour Party couldn't forgive him for. He was too damn successful.
Well, also, and it's slightly borne out, I suppose, of being elected in 1983, one of the worst results that the Labour Party had ever suffered, the longest suicide note in history and so on, when they'd already been in opposition by that point for 4 years. And he arrived, you know, anyone in a new job is all excitable and enthusiastic, quite quickly becomes bored with the idea of being in opposition. But at a time when the Labour Party wasn't really concerned about, you know, doing the right thing and feeling good about themselves was more important than winning. And the idea of even discussing how you might win an election was seen as a sort of traitorous thing to do to the cause.
Well, there were people working on this. And of course, Neil Kinnock did a lot of the donkey work and then failed to win in 1992. Meanwhile, Tony Blair found himself sharing a windowless office with a much more experienced and much better known figure from Edinburgh, from Kirkcaldy, Gordon Brown, who had already been a famous figure at Edinburgh University, became rector of the university, knew a lot about politics, had a tremendous ability to devise the right sound bites, tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. That was one he gave to Blair, who was at that point shadow foreign secretary. But you're right, the Labour Party was in a desperate mess, and someone like Blair might have joined the SDP. He didn't. He joined Labour, and Labour gradually got back into contention, looked as though they were going to win in 1992, and then didn't. And at that point, Gordon Brown didn't go for the leadership. He let John Smith take it. 2 years later, John Smith had a heart attack, and Blair went for it, to Brown's lasting, disappointment is too soft a word. He felt very, very bitter about this, but he had to accept it. And of course, Blair was a much better communicator than Brown. And at his first Labour Party conference as leader, he said to his one of his key people, Philip Gould, he said, "I think the time has come to give the Labour Party some electric shock treatment," which was getting rid of Clause 4. And God, the poor Labour people cried out in agony, but other people thought that must mean that Blair was, you know, got a grip on his own party and could be trusted to run the country.
And I suppose that's the thing, and we've seen it more recently, you know, when Keir Starmer became Labour leader, when he talked about unity was, you know, the key. And actually, because people don't like divided parties, but actually the point of having the fight with the Labour Party over Clause 4 was partly because he didn't think that the state should be owning it. That was actually his view and economically. But also, there was a purpose in the fight, in being seen to have that fight and win that fight with your own side to change the public perception of the Labour Party.
There was a purpose in the fight. Some people say, actually, that whoever had been Labour leader, the Tories were doing so badly after Black Wednesday in 1992, that their economic credibility was so shot to pieces, and they'd been in power for so long, and there were such problems with Tory sleeves and with Maastricht and everything, that anyone would have won, and that the Blairite, there's a very good book called The Myth of the Strong Leader by Archie Brown, which suggests that Blair didn't make much difference. But anyhow, he certainly took advantage of he was astute, and he took advantage of the situation, and Labour came in when the economy was already doing well, and they didn't throw it away. Or not immediately. So Blair does deserve credit for that.
And I suppose it's possible that another Labour leader would have won the election in 97, but perhaps not an historic landslide, which actually then meant he'd got the headroom to basically whittle that away over to win three elections.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, another Labour leader might have only won a bit. The Tories wouldn't have been quite so destroyed, and the Tories might have been back in contention by 2001. And the extraordinary thing that Tony Blair did was sort of redefine a decade in politics.
And he got his party to accept pretty much everything, all the Thatcherite reforms, including the union reforms. But he did find public sector reform, of course, it is very, very difficult. He said he had the scars on his back after 2 years of of trying to make a start on that. So he got increasingly interested in foreign affairs. He had successes in Kosovo and Sierra Leone. And then the big question, what after the attack on the Twin Towers, he absolutely went in shoulder to shoulder with the Americans. And of course, the Iraq War, which many people will never forgive Tony Blair for, he launched that, and it was a great sort of crusade to bring democracy to Iraq and indeed to Afghanistan. And of course, the whole thing became, the occupation became, which for which no preparation had been made, became terribly bloody. And Blair and his closest associates were accused of pretending that there were, or telling us that there were weapons of mass destruction, which there weren't. So that was a catastrophe from which I think one has to say his reputation has yet to recover.
Is that just what happens to prime ministers, do you think? There were so, you know, Blair's was the worst one since Suez. Bold politicians end up mucking it up in the end.
It happens to the most of them. Lord Salisbury managed to retire at a time of his own choosing, having led Britain through the rigours of the Boer War, which had gone jolly badly to start with. Baldwin again managed to retire at a time of his choosing, and so did Harold Wilson. But it's very, very unusual. And usually these people, they feel their powers declining. They feel that actually they're not very well and that they've been in for quite a while, and they're astute enough. But it's very, very difficult. And Blair, of course, clung. He simply wouldn't hand over to Brown. And the Brownite thugs only came for him after the 2005 election. And in 2006, he was forced to promise to go in 2007. So he clung on for a very long time. And of course, like most of us, he'd come to regard himself as indispensable. Not you, Matt.
I'm definitely not indispensable. Is it right to rank Tony Blair alongside the sort of great, and by great, I mean sort of influential and successful on their own terms, rather than necessarily the politics of it. But is he ranked alongside Margaret Thatcher? Who else would we put on that? I mean, certainly the Conservative Party seems to divide itself between the Thatcherites and the people who thought that David Cameron was the heir to Blair. You know, their surname means something in politics in the way that May and Brown maybe don't.
I don't think the term Blairite, it does have a big resonance. In fact, it caused terrible trouble within the Labour Party if you were tagged a Blairite. That made it very difficult to get anywhere after Blair. I think the term has rather died down now. And there are, as far as I can tell, there are fewer people who went into Labour politics because they were inspired by Tony Blair. There are still quite a lot of Tories at the top level who went in because they were inspired by Thatcher. So I think she did have of course, the country was in a much deeper difficulties in 1979 than it was 18 years later when Blair took over. So in a way, there was more for her to do, but she did do it. And did several, I mean, Blair did things like the Northern Ireland peace process, completed what John Major had started. He did devolution, big things, but not quite as big as the task confronting Thatcher in 79.
Is it a little unfair for us even to be assessing the political impact of, we're going to do it for the rest of the week with the other prime ministers. How long do you think someone needs to be out of office before we can properly get a handle on the shape of their premiership?
It is a bit unfair. And it can change. But in fact, it often happens very quickly, I think, that a prime minister's reputation becomes fairly fixed in the public mind because we find it difficult to remember very much about, if anything. You're right, some we don't really remember anything at all, but we find it difficult to remember much. And I'm afraid Chamberlain, although many people have made great attempts to rescue his reputation, he's never really recovered from the propaganda in 1940, according to which he was one of the guilty men who hadn't dealt with the Nazis and was to blame for Britain being pitifully unprepared in 1939. So his reputation has never recovered. And so sometimes these things do become pretty much fixed. I think probably, Thatcher, perhaps more of her erstwhile opponents would now admit she was a considerable figure than were prepared to do that at the time. But Blair has this, trouble is he has this virtuous, this self-righteous tone, trying to convince not only himself, but the rest of us that he's a noble person. And that becomes very tiresome. In some ways, he's his own worst enemy, I think.
Yeah, he doesn't realise it. Somebody else needs to redefine his reputation. He's
yes, not exactly. You can't control your own reputation fully. I mean, you can do your best, but telling people what to think is not tactful, really.
So that is the Life and Times of Tony Blair, number 51 in our list of prime ministers. Andrew, number 52.
Yes, Gordon Brown, big figure, the clunking fist, had waited. Who knows, perhaps he would have been a very great prime minister if he'd come in 97, but he'd waited for 10 years pretending to be satisfied with the job of Chancellor of the Exchequer and being a considerable Chancellor of the Exchequer, but he stayed in that job so long that there was a crash. And of course, he'd said that he'd unwisely promised that he'd abolish Bloom and Bust. He hadn't. No one can, actually. So in he came after, when the Labour Party was already quite, not exactly exhausted, but it does exact a real toll on you, and it exacted a toll on Brown. And then he had a honeymoon when he came in 2007. Everything went well for several months, and people thought he was going to call a general election, and he didn't quite have the audacity to go for it. And that was possibly a fatal mistake, because very soon after that, we had Northern Rock and the economy in a dreadful state, and the whole bank. He applied himself to saving the banking system.
Saved the world, in fact, he claimed at one point.
He misspoke. He said he saved the world, but he had actually been a big figure in saving the world banking system. He understood how to do that. Very good at it. But, of course, the question of why this had happened after 10 years of Labour government was a difficult one to evade, and he couldn't quite get on the front foot again after that, after his brief honeymoon was over. And people could see the burden of high office, which of course is very, very heavy, weighed very heavily on him. The more trouble he was in, the harder he worked, but he was exhausted, his fingernails were bitten down. He brought back Peter Mandelson, which was an imaginative stroke. Wonderfully.
Tony Blair saying that he would be successful when the Labour Party loved Peter Mandelson. Yes. Even getting to the point where Gordon Brown loved Peter Mandelson enough to bring him back was
Gordon Brown realised he needed Peter Mandelson. And Peter Mandelson, of course, many years earlier, had put the young Brown and the young Blair on the telly a lot, because they were so much better than the older generation of Labour politicians at selling the Labour message. But that was a long time ago. Anyhow, they knew each other very well. And Mandelson probably did help Brown to defeat one or two half-hearted rebellions led by people like David Miliband by ringing round the conspirators and persuading them not to overthrow the Prime Minister. So Brown got to the 2010 general election, but then lost and still tried to cling on, tried to do some sort of a deal with the Liberals, but the numbers weren't really there. It was obvious that although Cameron and the Conservatives had not got an overall majority, they had got a lot more seats than Labour, and so they really had the sort of moral right to show what they could do. So the whole thing was very, very sad. This in a way, great man, and in many ways a successful Chancellor until the crash, and then not quite able to cope, not quite decisive enough. And you get so many decisions crossing your desk every day as Prime Minister. He wouldn't delegate them, and he couldn't really take them, or he found it very difficult to take those decisions himself.
Do you think that's one of the things that's come across? We've been doing this all year. Every week we've done one of the prime ministers, and some people just can't do it. And actually, it takes a very rare collection of skills that means that you can do it. And actually, almost the fact that he's the sort of person who didn't call the election, the fact he's the sort of person who didn't go for the leadership in the 90s, all of that points to someone who lacks that extra sprinkle of something that ultimately might make you a better person at the job.
Yes, the big match temperament, which, curious enough, can come from not taking it with terrible sort of Calvinistic seriousness. I mean, I think he is a man of moral seriousness, and his father, of course, was a minister in Kirkcaldy. But the sort of Calvinistic attitude to things is, Calvinists find it difficult to relax, perhaps. I'm too worried by...
You can take being the minister in a church very seriously and completely dedicate yourself to it, but you can't do it with the same intensity if the Archbishop of Canterbury running all churches.
No.
You can't focus on every single church with the same... And that's Gordon Brown's problem, was that if an issue arose, he wanted to read every report on that subject ever before making a decision.
Admirable, but plainly not practical when you're the top person. So But it's so difficult following a dominant person. And Anthony Eden found that following Churchill. And Churchill said, more or less the night before Eden took over, I'm not sure Anthony can do it. I think Blair had similar doubts about Gordon's ability to do it. But of course, Gordon was the heir apparent. No one else. He'd made sure that he had no rivals. They at least had been dealt with by the Brownites. And so in he came, but it was in the end, as is often the case, it was an unhappy victory for him.
There's something about, and maybe it's just coincidence, we shouldn't read too much into it, but the fact that history repeated itself so quickly, the dominant era-defining prime minister gives way to chancellor who oversees huge decline of their party before handing over to opposition. Yes. Thatcher to Major, Blair to Brown. Actually, to some extent, Cameron to May in a similar way. You know, the person who takes over from someone who really came to define a political era.
Yes.
It's a very difficult thing to sort of pick up and run with. And maybe it was just someone has to do it, but you're sort of doomed to failure by that point.
Yes. I mean, of course, you're determined to become prime minister. So you accept it on those terms. But it is actually to renew yourself in office is incredibly difficult. They were successful after 97, partly because they had thought out quite carefully in opposition what they were going to do and how they were going to stick to the... I mean, Brown had realised that if you promised to spend more than the Tories, you would immediately be regarded as reckless. So they promised to stick to the Tory spending limits. And Brown worked that out in opposition, and they did it. And it all went fine. But that was because they had had the leisure to think about it. And in office, you don't have any leisure to think about things.
I wonder, have you seen the Brown-Blair documentaries that came out this year?
I saw some of it, actually. I haven't got around to watching all of it.
Well, yeah, Christmas is coming. But one of the things that really... One of the things that really struck me was that Tony Blair was actually quite reflective of his period and realising where things had gone wrong, and maybe I should have done that, but at the time I thought it was... Gordon Brown is not a man for self-reflection. He still thinks that he was very hard done by, and actually he was very good. And I just wonder whether, again, that sort of speaks to someone who just wasn't quite right for that top job.
I think that's true, but of course it's very easy for us as spectators, I mean very interested spectators, but spectators not bearing the burdens of it, to say that. And it's difficult to think who would have done it better, actually. But you're right, he somehow didn't quite have the ability to relax into the thing. But I think he obviously won a great deal of respect for the tenacity and conscientiousness with which he at least dealt with the financial crisis.
Well, that is Gordon Brown, number 52 on our list of prime ministers.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Well, let's move on to number 53 then. Out goes Gordon Brown and in comes David Cameron, the Tory party's attempt. Well, if you can't beat them, join them. Their own heir to Blair. Andrew, did David Cameron live up to billing?
Well, he ran a coalition with the Liberal Democrats for 5 years, which lots of people thought wouldn't last, but they'd done the preparation. The press was very struck by Cameron having been in the Bullingdon Club at Oxford and having been to Eton, and they thought this must mean he was a sort of toff, which in a way he is. But the much more important thing politically was that he spent time after Oxford in the Conservative Research Department, and he'd learned the profession of politics, the difference between good briefing and bad briefing, what you can say in any given circumstance and what you can't. He was there at Norman Lamont's side, providing the words about it's been a very difficult and turbulent day. Words written by David Cameron as a special advisor, young special advisor, in 1992, when the pound crashed out of the exchange rate mechanism after putting interest rates up to 15% and wasting a lot of money in a vain attempt to save the situation. So Cameron, although very young, had already had a lot of political experience and a lot of political expertise. And he had a group of friends who'd also been in the Conservative Research Department, George Osborne, Ed Llewellyn, quite a few others, who knew how this stuff should be done and who had seen, who to some extent had learned from mistakes of the previous Conservative administration. So Cameron came in and he was very, for a time, it was a very skillful performance, and they'd filleted the Lib Dem manifesto. Oliver Letwin had done that at Cameron's behest. So they were absolutely prepared for the coalition talks, 5 days of coalition, and they stay in office for 5 years. And then win, very unexpectedly, they won some extra seats in 2015, got a slim overall majority, and the poor old Lib Dems had been killed with kindness. They had a catastrophe. The weaker, the junior partner in the coalition very often does suffer, and that was certainly Nick Clegg. I was there in the garden at number 10. He looked indecently happy when he became deputy prime minister in 2010.
It was an extraordinary moment, that.
It was extraordinary, yes. He was so happy, and it all went so... to their credit, in a way, they were in office for 5 years, but then the Liberals had a very, very, very disappointing time in 2015.
I mean, maybe there's a whole new series on deputy prime ministers of our time.
Yes.
I'd always argue that Nick Clegg did at least implement more Lib Dem policies than any other Lib Dem leader ever.
Yes, I mean,
I mean, you could... I mean, tuition fees is one... We're getting slightly diverted. Tuition fees is one question, but the... You know, being in government every day and making decisions, implementing your manifesto has always got to be better, surely, than being in opposition.
Well,
Up until the point you lose your seat,
it's the point at which you sell your own soul, I suppose. But, and of course, the Tories stole quite a lot of, or they sort of took the credit for things like cutting or raising the income tax thresholds for.
Yeah. The thing that David Cameron said in 2010 was unaffordable, and is now, even now, is still a flagship Tory conservative policy.
Yes.
Yeah. Just rewind a bit back to 2010, because I always think this slightly gets skipped over in the sort of the history of David Cameron. He gained 96 seats in the 2010 election, went from 210 to 306. And in the world of, you know, people always complained that, you know, he didn't quite seal the deal, and why did he fall short? It was they were still so far behind after the 2005 election that gaining 96 seats, you know, 91 off of Labour, 5 off the Lib Dems because the Lib Dems went backwards, was an extraordinary achievement.
Yes, and people thought that David Davis was going to get it in 2005, and he didn't, because Cameron showed more promise and gave better speeches and so on, and there seemed to be something sort of new and hopeful about him. And I think the Tory party made the right choice there, although David Davis has very considerable qualities. Probably Cameron was better at being leader, even if his stunts, like sort of going off with the Huskies and to show that he was keen on green stuff, were in some ways rather ridiculous. But it was very impressive.
But they weren't.
Performance, and the Tories had done so badly for so long against Labour that there was a real need to try something new.
And those things, I mean, they seem visible now because they've been done to death and all of that. But at the time, even David Cameron not wearing a tie was seen as a subject of national discussion.
Yes.
You know, the riding his bike, albeit with his shoes being brought by the car afterwards.
Yes.
Do you remember Webb Cameron? The sort of early foray into sort of YouTube, where David Cameron doing the washing up while talking about welfare reform or whatever it might be, to say, look, I'm nothing to do with Michael Howard and Ian Duncan Smith. There's a whole new shiny Conservative party.
Yes, and he did bring in same-sex marriage, actually, to the absolute horror of many older Tory members. He was very much held to the old view that marriage was between a man and a woman. And that there he really shocked his own party by doing that, but of course it's remained. He was a very Anglican figure in some ways, because he very much believed in good behavior and in compromise, but as far as doctrine was concerned, he was fairly flexible about that.
We can't obviously talk about David Cameron without discussing so he wins this unexpected, you know, so the coalition everyone thought would collapse didn't.
Yes.
Then he wins this unexpected Tory majority, which would see him sail into the... You know, he wanted to leave on his own terms. He said before the 2015 election he wouldn't fight another one. And instead didn't get to leave on his own terms because he called this blooming referendum. His magic touch didn't, it eluded him at a crucial moment in June 2016.
He thought he could, I mean, they'd held the referendum on Scottish independence and had won after by 55 to 45, but after a lot of anxiety, but he somehow, he's like a bridge player, he thought he could finesse the thing by having another referendum. And he did need to do something. UKIP were rampant in the middle of that 2010, 2015 parliament, and Tory members and councillors and one or two Tory MPs were starting to peel away, and he had to do something. And what he did was promise the referendum. And his policy, obviously, was you can have your referendum, he said to his Eurosceptics, but I'm going to win it. Unfortunately, the second bit did not turn out to be the case. He didn't conduct a tough enough renegotiation. Perhaps that was impossible. The Germans didn't help him at all. British politicians are inclined to think the Germans are going to help them, and Germans generally don't. So, of course, a lot of people will never forgive him for having held that referendum and lost it. And he didn't manage to keep people like Michael Gove, who worked very, very successfully for him and who he thought was a close friend. But Gove went with Leave, and so did Boris Johnson. And Remain fought a bad campaign. There was a very contradictory campaign because they said it was a leap in the dark to leave Europe, but they also said it would cost each of us exactly sort of £4,223.50 per week or something, or per year or whatever it was. And the two messages sort of couldn't both be true. So
It can't be a leap into the known unknown. Misquote someone before. It's sort of amazing that David Cameron ends up being hated by everyone. Remainers hate him because we left the EU, and Leavers hate him despite the fact it's only thanks to him that they got the thing that they wanted. But the way he fought it, they never really liked him anyway, and he was never one of us or whatever. Certainly within the Tory party, if not the country more generally. And then just to really finish it off, he's done his best to disgrace himself since leaving office.
Yes, the lobbying stuff obviously is a blot on his reputation. Ideally, I think former prime ministers would stay in parliament, which Theresa May has. Gordon Brown did for a bit, not for very long, and give parliament the benefit of their experience. He hasn't done that. And then this sort of on wishy-say-vous stuff and lobbying of former colleagues isn't that has damaged his reputation. But you said nobody likes him. I suppose it shows what a feeble person I am. I do rather like him. Not a proper journalist at all.
You're allowed to like him. I'm not saying that. Maybe he seems to have unnecessarily lost some friends along the way.
He has lost many friends, yes. But he's preserved a fitting silence, I think. He hasn't always been giving lots of advice, despite being out of parliament. He's left his successors to get on with it, which I think he deserves some credit for that.
Yes, something that I suspect that Boris Johnson would rather Theresa May took that a similar vow of silence slightly. We'll come on to her, but for now, that was David Cameron. So, Andrew, number 54, Theresa May, only the second woman to become Prime Minister. Where to begin? I mean, I suppose we should go right back to the beginning, really, because Theresa May had been in politics for a very long time. And not always destined for greatness, necessarily.
Well, she was the most able, by far the most able, of the very small number of women Tory MPs elected in 1997. But you're right, she wasn't identified. But this is true of Margaret Thatcher as well, actually. She was the ablest member of the 1959 intake. But again, people didn't spot in her, or very few people spotted in her a future Prime Minister. Few people spotted it in May. She first came to sort of wider attention. She became Tory party chairman and told people, the Tories in Bournemouth in 2002, that they were still quite widely seen as the nasty party. And a lot of Tories rather held that against her. But anyhow, she was a very capable person. And in 2010, Cameron sent her to the Home Office, which is a nightmare department in many ways. There are all sorts of horrible things which can go wrong. And she gripped it and she took on the police federation. She dealt with various very tricky extradition cases from about 2013. She started to give speeches which sort of ranged beyond her brief, and lo and behold, during the referendum campaign she was a Remainer but more or less totally silent. She wouldn't help.
She gave one speech which was quite Leavey. It was like, these are all the reasons why the EU is terrible, and that's why I think on the whole we should stay.
Exactly. And then in the amazing period immediately after the referendum, when Cameron resigned and Boris Johnson became the front runner, and then his close colleague, Michael Gove, said he was not fit to be prime minister. And Theresa May suddenly looked like the only grown-up person in the room. And she was actually, I mean, she's 10 years older than David Cameron. She's from an older, sort of from a sort of 1970s Oxford generation of politicians. And so she came through and she was very, very popular to begin with. She was a delightful change, people thought, just what the country needed. And she said she would deal with the rather tricky matter of Brexit. She then decided she didn't have quite the majority she needed. And so she called an election. And of course, that's when it all went terribly wrong, because I think a lot of voters thought they'd already given their instructions in the referendum the previous year, which was to leave the European Union and get on and do it. Why would someone who offering strong and stable leadership bothering to make them go to the polls, make us go to the polls again? And so although, in fact, the Conservative vote went up a bit, the Labour vote on Jeremy Corbyn appealed turned out to be rather a good campaigner. And she, of course, was a very poor campaigner who couldn't connect with people.
Isn't it interesting that Gordon Brown's maligned for not calling a general election, and almost exactly 10 years later,
yes,
Theresa May is maligned because she did call a general election. Well, both probably convinced themselves of the merits of their decision at the time, but they define their premiership.
It seemed an easier decision for her because the Tories had such dominance in the polls, and so the received wisdom was that Corbyn would be hopeless, and so no one would vote for Corbyn. Well, because Corbyn wasn't expected to win, people thought they could vote for him as a protest, as a result of which he did rather well. And meanwhile, she had things like the dementia tax, which were, you know...
Nothing has changed.
Nothing, exactly. So she fought a very poor campaign. Then, however, she remained in office for two more years. And she'd put the Eurosceptics in these senior ministerial posts, most notably Boris Johnson as Foreign Secretary. She ground out a sort of agreement. She summoned everyone to Chequers, and then they went home, and first David Davis resigned in protest of the Chequers agreement, and then Boris Johnson thought he'd got to as well.
He resigned in protest at all the media coverage that David Davis had.
And it looked then as if her position was already very weak after the 2017 election. After Chequers, it was even weaker, and yet she remained, I think, because a lot of Tory MPs cast around for a stop Boris candidate, and they couldn't find one. So she became, by default, the stop Boris figure. And they went on hoping for a long time that somehow she could sort this wretched Brexit business out, but she couldn't. And
do you think it was, at that point, unsought-outable, the position that she was in? Or was there something about Theresa May as a person, as a politician, as a negotiator, as a people person, that actually meant that she was unable to sort it out?
I think she sort of pretended to have a grip on it, probably tried even to convince herself that she had a grip on it, but she didn't entirely, and she made unwise... I mean, the Irish border situation was logically insoluble, but she made unwise concessions early on, possibly without realising that she was making unwise concessions about how there must be completely free north-south trade, which meant there was going to be some problem east-west. I think the Irish negotiators were well prepared, and so were the commission, the European Commission's our negotiators were had not properly thought this through, and certainly our politicians hadn't. That was partly Cameron's fault. He wouldn't make any preparations for losing the vote. So we absolutely hadn't thought about it. And we were up against people who had thought a lot about it. And she made a hash of it. So I think, although it was a very difficult situation, I think her record as a negotiator was rather mixed, and she wasn't good at eventually sort of striking up a rapport with whoever it was notoriously these deals are done at the last minute, but then you probably do need to have some rapport with the person who you go to see in Brussels, and she generally didn't manage that.
I remember, I think it was Nick Clegg saying that he'd have, when he was Deputy Prime Minister and she was Home Secretary, they used to clash quite a lot on law and order and civil liberties and so on, and he went to David Cameron and said, I'm having this real problem with Theresa May because they were trying to negotiate something. And he'd go to Theresa May, and she said, this is what I think. And he said, well, yeah, I know, but this is what I think. But I'm willing to go to this. What do you think? And she'd just say, no. And so we go, well, okay, well, I'll concede this. What are you going to concede? She said, well, nothing. And it's went on yes. and on and on, where she just refused, point blank. Yes. That was her idea of negotiating, was to keep yes. saying no to where the other person now. And Nick Clegg said this to David Cameron and sort of set out this issue that she's been completely impossible in whatever I suggest, she won't yes. budge. And David Cameron's response was, oh, thank God, I just thought she was like that with me.
Yeah.
And maybe in the world of, you can do that if you're Home Secretary because you've got your own yes. empire and you can just sit and just lock yes. in. But if you are, you know, basically negotiating with your own cabinet, with Parliament and Brussels,
yes.
and your stock position with all of them is, no, I'm going to sit here until they agree with me.
Yes.
In the end, no, it doesn't work. It doesn't work.
No, it didn't
we
work.
Should reflect on the fact that she is in the 55 we're talking about, only the second woman. One of them was there for 10 years and one of them was there for, what, two, three? Three.
Yes, three, actually, yes. Longer than it.
Should we read anything into that or are they just politicians? Does being a woman in politics make any difference to Theresa May, do you think?
I think it does make a difference. And actually, one of the good things she's done with Ann Jenkin is encouraged a lot more women to try to become Tory MPs and mentored, gifted people. So a lot of good people have come in, partly a result of Theresa May showing that it can be done. And you do really have to encourage people because in some ways it's such a commitment of time and energy and reputation and everything that you do need encouragement to go in for it. And traditionally men have been more likely to say, I'd be a wonderful MP, than women are less inclined to puff themselves in that intolerable fashion. So Theresa May was very, very good at encouraging high quality women to think about becoming Tory MPs.
And the Parliament has definitely changed as a result of that.
Yeah, and it's also very good, I must say, it's very good that she stayed in Parliament.
I agree.
And you don't, there's more to politics than being a minister or indeed being a prime minister. You should stay there and give the nation the benefit of your experience. And she's doing that.
And actually, there's a parallel universe where the Commons has four or five former prime ministers, former chancellors, former... Yes. Home Secretaries who could say, look, we tried this. I know it doesn't work.
Yes.
I warned you about that. And, you know, that could yep. actually make a difference in the world. Yes. Well, that is Theresa May then, number 54
yes.
in our list of prime ministers. So, Andrew Jimson, we come to number 55. I've got a copy, my copy of Jimson's Prime Ministers, Brief Lives from Walpole to May, which I was just checking is not a signed copy. And you've definitely signed me a copy at some point. So I don't know whose copy I've got here. But we come then to number 55.
Yes.
I know it's been updated, your book, Brief Lives yes. of Walpole to Now Johnson.
Yes.
But in the front of the book, there were several quotes from former prime ministers about the life of politicians. Benjamin yes. Disraeli saying when he became prime minister in 1868, yes, I've climbed to the top of the greasy pole.
Yep.
One of my favourites is Harold Macmillan as prime minister, walking down a litter-filled corridor in a hotel in Clandudno during the Conservative Party Conference in 1962, saying Gladstone and Disraeli never had to put up with this. But the one I wanted to reflect on most, because I think it speaks yes. to slightly Boris Johnson, is the Clement Attlee quote. Clement Attlee said, there is one thing about politics that I think cannot be disputed. If a man stays in them long enough, they will nearly always reveal him for what he is, and he tends to not only get what he deserves, but to find in his fate the reflection of his own strength and weakness.
Yes.
And after all this, I mean, particularly this year and particularly this month, reflecting on Boris Johnson, lots of suggestions that Boris Johnson should change. And actually,
yes.
my sense is that politicians, or indeed people, do not change. And what we are seeing as 2021 comes to an end in Boris Johnson's premiership is just confirmation of what Boris Johnson is like.
Yes, I think he hasn't changed very much. And I've not only written a book about all the prime ministers, I wrote a biography about Boris Johnson, and the most quoted bit of it is the bit in one of his school reports by his housemaster, a brilliant man called Martin Hammond, who said that Boris expects to be an exception to the system of obligation that binds everyone else. And he got into quite a lot of trouble at Eton for doing things his own way. And for example, just turning up very, very late to a meeting with the provost and things, which most people would think was extremely rude and also somehow imprudent. And yet he got given the title captain of school, having missed out on it to begin with. But he got to the top, and he became a famous figure at school, famous for forgetting his lines or appearing to forget his lines in the middle of a play or a reading or whatever it was that he was doing. A famous figure at Oxford, again, president of the Union at the second attempt. And then a famous journalist from 1989 when he went to Brussels as the Telegraph's correspondent. And some of the other correspondents were furious with him because they thought that he embroidered his stories, and he undoubtedly did. He couldn't, he didn't really, he treated it almost as if he was a novelist. He wrote stories to sort of illuminate what he thought was going on in Brussels, that Jacques Delors was taking more power for the European Commission. And this absolutely infuriated his competitors. I mean, in those days, if you were a correspondent somewhere, you might get rung up at 11 o'clock at night, and you know, the Times or someone would say, look, the Daily Telegraph, Boris Johnson got this story in the Daily Telegraph. Could you follow it up for our second edition, please? An absolute nightmare, especially as the details in the story were often all wrong. So, though I would say that he got the big picture right, but one can't defend his...
Well, I suppose you would say that he was, you quite like the cause with which he was fighting rather than the detail.
I admired his ability not only to get the big picture, but to see when the story had changed. So when the story was no longer in Brussels, he got on the next plane to Belgrade and sort of got interested in the Balkans when that was suddenly where the story was. So anyhow, a capable journalist, but not, of course, very capable, obviously, at reaching the wider public. Then on Have I Got News For You, then editor of The Spectator and into Parliament in 2001 as MP for Henley. And this was during the long Blairite ascendancy. Several Tory leaders had already failed. Ian Duncan Smith was having a not very successful time. And people said, maybe Boris Johnson is the person we need. And then that was
a bit before my time in Westminster. Yes. Was he seen as a possible leader at that point?
He was, yes. And then he had various disasters at the end of 2004. One to do with Liverpool, one to do with the Pyramid of Piffle. And these disasters meant that Tory MPs were quite cross with him for remaining editor of The Spectator while also being MP for Henley. He just didn't have the time to spend in the chamber or in committee sort of doing the dreary stuff that lots of, but then when he turned up at Westminster on his bike, took him 11 minutes to cycle at high speed from the offices of The Spectator to Westminster. Of course, everyone was interested in him, whereas all these other poor people who were sort of toiling away very conscientiously, no one was interested in them. So he was quite unpopular, but nevertheless seen as a potential leader until these disasters at the end of 2004. He was sacked by Michael Howard from his position as a shadow arts spokesman. And so in 2005, when Howard lost the third election in a row to Labour, Johnson was not in position to challenge the leadership, and he backed David Cameron. But then Cameron kept him at a distance. The last thing Cameron wanted was some loose cannon old Etonian stealing his thunder. So Johnson, at that point, I think he could just have said, well, I'll be a celebrity. I'll have a television show. I'll have a very well-paid column. But he didn't. He went off and became and stood against Ken Livingstone for mayor of London. And Ken was thought
to be... The campaign that he was not expected to win at the very beginning.
No. Ken was thought to be unbeatable. And London, on the whole, a Labour-leaning city. And Johnson went and beat Livingstone, not once, but he stood again and beat him the second time in 2012. So that somehow... And that was a sort of a way of doing something very, very... It was a sort of outflanking manoeuvre, really. It put him in contention for when Cameron was no longer around. So he came back into Parliament in 2015, and then, of course... stood on the, after a lot of havering, I think he could see that there was a real argument about Europe, but he backed the leave side, and probably, I mean, the result was so close that I think one can say that he had a decisive impact. And so, of course, he's been hated since then by those Remainers who felt completely bereaved by the result. And then he didn't get, it seemed only just that he should deal with the problem or the difficulties
of his creation,
of his creation. But of course, he was denounced by Michael Gove, and then I think then decided not to sort of fight on to the bitter end, and then amazingly became Foreign Secretary. So it was a real sort of roller coaster thing. But as Foreign Secretary, May did not trust him. Not only did she not trust him, but she made fun of him in public. She made jokes about him at the party conference and on various other occasions. She sort of really cut him down to size and wouldn't. And you can't be a successful foreign secretary if the prime minister of the day doesn't want to work with you.
There's something interesting about that, isn't it? Is the perception of Boris Johnson is that he's a gregarious, fun-loving, jokey guy you want to go down the pub
yeah.
with. And actually, he's a bit of a loner. Like you said, he didn't have lots yes. of friends in Parliament. He's not really yes. a team player. And he's also quite thin-skinned. So it's all right for him to go around taking the mickey out of everyone else. But he's quite, you know, he can yes. be a bit sore if somebody does it back.
Yes. When he does it, he always thinks he can mend fences. And so he does make the call or send the text or whatever in order to do so. And Englishmen on the whole are rather bad at that and tend to sort of retreat into a grieved silence. So sort of grievances confessed. And he tries not to do that. But yes, in he came, Theresa May, having failed to get Brexit done. And he did get Brexit done after several months in the autumn of 2019, the prorogation and the withdrawal of the whip from 21 Conservatives, really, and tremendous sort of and losing control of the House of Commons, and then going to the country and winning an 80-seat majority.
An extraordinary result. Which is yes. still, I mean, in the depths now of record rebellions and all of that, still extraordinary yes. to have put on, you know, to have won that result and to have won those seats in the places that he did.
Yes, the Tory vote had increased at every general election, I think, since 2001, but not by very much. So there was a rising tide, but then to actually break through in substantial number of Labour seats. And it was very much his, I mean, I spoke to a Tory MP who went canvassing quite, he had a safe seat in the Midlands and he went canvassing quite a bit in the North. And he would say at the end, thank you so much for supporting the Conservative Party. And to which the person would invariably reply, oh yes, I'm voting for Boris. So it was a personal, there was a personal element in that. And course, people then, were so fed up with Brexit by then that get Brexit done was a brilliant sort of slogan.
Yeah, I suppose that was the thing, is that it became a, you know, I will end the chaos argument, yes. which was a thing that resonated. We haven't even really touched on coronavirus and his handling of that, whether or not he was particularly well suited to. I just want to sort of round off by looking back on all yes. of his 54 predecessors. And at various points, it's just been, you know, almost by coincidence, whoever we've been doing, we've reflected on the fact that that's a bit like Boris Johnson, or this is a bit like Boris Johnson. Who do you think in the grand sweep of his 54 predecessors, Boris Johnson really is most like? And does that give us any clue of what 2022 and the coming years might have in store for him?
The Tory leader who he most resembles is Disraeli. One of very few Tory leaders to have made a living from words. Disraeli's novels are better than Boris Johnson's novel, but they have a similar audacity. Success is the child of audacity, Disraeli once wrote, and that is a maxim by which Boris Johnson lives and by which perhaps at some point his career will end.
Well, it's been absolutely fascinating, Andrew, doing this every week this year with a bumper crop to round off with. Jimson's Prime Minister's Brief Lives from Walpole to Johnson is available if you're doing some last-minute Christmas
yes.
shopping for that political nerd in your life. Well, the beauty of it is rather than reading your great big long book on Boris Johnson, you can read the same length book and it covers all of them.
It does. Thank you, Matt.
Andrew, thank you so much for joining us every week. And we look forward to doing the same again next year.
Thank you so much.
What are we going to do next year, Andrew? Are we doing kings and queens or US presidents?
Well, I think we should have lunch. And it's a big question, which can't be decided on the spur of the moment.
Lunch in the new year. Perfect.
Yep.
Whenever we're allowed to. Andrew Jimson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
So there you have it, the most recent Prime Ministers from Thatcher to Johnson. And if you're still looking for some late Christmas shopping, I can't recommend enough Jimson's Prime Ministers Brief Lives from Walpole to Johnson. It's a cracking week. It's really good. Right, coming up on the podcast tomorrow, the tables are really turned. Luke Jones presents Weekend Breakfast on Times Radio, interviews me, Matt Shirley. Find out what happens on the podcast tomorrow.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.